Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice. We at Shattered Lives are so excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator, getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. Prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case or the organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please, please don't forget, it's very important that if you can't tune in from 5 to 6 Eastern, you can listen at any time, anywhere on our archival feature, and just look for the big red heart with the cracks. And so good evening and welcome to another lively and informative evening with Lady Justice here at Shattered Lives. I welcome you as always. And I want to start out tonight by just giving you a little bit of news. Lady Justice just got back from the Melanie I. Rieger Conference at Central Connecticut State University in Connecticut with wonderful and inspiring guests. And I was able to work a little magic there for myself as well as some of our colleagues, and just a tremendous conference. And I wanted to let you know that I'm always available to work some magic for you as a consultant, as a writer, as an employee of your PI firm or victim services firm. And I guess I have to say I'm also the hardest working person this side of the Mississippi, and I think my co-host will validate that.
I will vouch for that.
Thank you so much.
I know. Your energy is so high.
Well, you don't know how I guess. But anyway, a little bit about my co-host. You know, I had the good fortune to discover Imagine Publicity almost like pennies from heaven, almost nearly 2 years ago. And pennies from heaven, there's a definition that says that it's an angel letting you know that you are with you in spirit. And Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity, is that angel to me. They specialize in social media marketing, and one of the things that she does very, very well is website design. And even if your budget doesn't allow you to pay her $1 million, her work looks like $1 million, and she works within your budget. And so here we have a skilled PR person, and we have someone with a heart as big as the size of Texas. So what more could I ask for? The two main ingredients. So Delilah, thanks for being on my team, and thanks for being my co-host.
Oh, I wouldn't have it any other way, Donna. Thank you. I'm always so surprised each week when you start introducing me. You do it so well, and I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. I think you deserve a lot of credit because you make me look good. And so without further ado, we have a couple of people that don't need any promotion because their reputation speaks for themselves, but we want to do it anyway because they're in one part of the country, and those people way in the west and the north and the south need to hear about them. Tonight, my esteemed guests are Robin Moore and Chuck Elgin. And now, Robin Moore is a founder and captain of Cumberland Canine Search and Recovery Team, and it's a nonprofit organization specializing in human remains search and recovery. And she's also the Tennessee State Outreach Coordinator for the Q Center for the Missing Persons. And she was also the recipient of their 2012 Keeper of the Flame Award, and she's been with them approximately 7 years as a consultant, and I'll let her tell you what Keeper of the Flame is. And let me just say a little bit about Chuck Elgin here, and then we'll bring him on. Chuck Elgin, former DJ, but that's not why he's here. Chuck Elgin is a chief of North Carolina Underwater Response Team and a certified scuba instructor as well as a firefighter. And he's had over 23 years experience with sonar equipment and underwater search and recovery. And he's been a volunteer with Q Center for at least 12 years. And he's a certified incident command instructor, so he brings a lot to the table. Robin and Chuck, thank you so much for being our guests, and welcome. Come on board.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Donna.
It's my pleasure to have you. You know, my first introduction to your specialties probably was this past March when I had the good fortune to attend my first Q Center conference for the missing as well as be a presenter. And I know I'd spoken with you earlier. I would really like the two of you to share the details of what happened during that conference, because I think it is very illustrative of what you do. There happened to be an incident that occurred, and the two of you rose to the occasion and put your resources together, and you accomplished very good things. So, Robin and Chuck, why don't you relate to us what happened? Either one of you, would you like to start, Robin?
Sure. Actually, I had attended the Q Center conference, and I had taken my Labrador Retriever, who is what we call a cadaver dog or a human remains detection dog, and he attended the conference with me. Basically, I was taking him because he is 10 years old, and I'm pretty much retiring him out, so this was kind of his last big hoorah, taking him there. We were also, like I said, received their 2012 Keeper of the Flame Award, which is actually given to a volunteer of the year. So that's why we had gone there. And during the conference at the last night, we received a call that there were two missing boaters that were presumed drowned, and they had been unable to locate their body. So they actually had a sheriff from their county was at this Q Center conference, and they contacted us to see about if we could possibly send the dog and also Chuck down with his sonar to help them locate the bodies. So,
wow.
Yes. So it was
Chuck,
kind of bittersweet.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Now, Chuck, how did you come to know about this, and what was your part in it?
Well, as the conference was going, we were down there presenting an update on sonar, some of the new enhancements to the sonar unit, some of the units that are out there, and some of the differences in capabilities, or as an educational possibility for people to become more knowledgeable of the sonar. I'd actually completed the second day round of lectures that we were giving on that in the classrooms, and it actually had started back home and received a telephone call that said, "How far away are you?" "Oh, just a few minutes away. Can you turn around and come back? We've got a request."
Is that
for,
right?
Some sonar assistance. So, yeah, we just turned around, came back, and met up with the Q folks down there that were coordinating that, and then got up with Robin and with the I believe it was one of their detectives, or might have been one of their lieutenants up from the South Carolina group down there that was attending the conference, and got briefed on what had just happened the day before in their area down there, and was requesting assistance in locating these two missing people from this boat. So Rob and I said, "Well, yeah, we'll do that." Robin had to hustle off some airplane changes, and Robin, I think your mother was down there with you too, so
yeah.
We had to make some arrangements for her to be missing you that evening.
Your mother.
My only request was them, if you've got to get me back to the hotel the next morning by 9 o'clock so that I can pick up my mom and my luggage and head to the airport to fly home.
Well,
it was a drive.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I would say we were about 3 hours from the requested location. So,
wow.
It was like 9 o'clock or so at night when we left and got down there about midnight, which was the opportune time to run because we didn't have any influence from any other outside sources at that time. So it gave Robin and Roscoe, isn't it, Robin, the dog name? Roscoe,
correct.
Yeah. The dog a good chance to do their things, which is a good it's a level setting. If you're going to start in with resources, the dogs probably are well in front of the sonar when we're working in an unknown area, an undefined type area. So the dogs can zero down what we can get in and run sonar and narrow down more on specific target interests. So, yeah, it was kind of a long night.
I'm sure it was. Can you just briefly kind of set the scene and the circumstances of what it was? I believe, from my knowledge, and I wrote an extensive blog on it, there was a group of young men on a pontoon boat, and they may have been imbibing a little bit, and they went in the water. To my recollection, the motor burned out or something, and I don't know if they were waiting for assistance, but some of them jumped in the water because they were hot and they never made it up. Is that, am I right in that?
Well, that's kind of the general idea there. Is just they were a younger generation out having fun on the lake itself. The lake is a private lake. It's a power company cooling lake as opposed to like a core lake or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the boat engine malfunctioned on them. They were somewhat near shore. It's not a very wide lake, although it's kind of long. And I guess one of them had jumped in with the trying to swim maybe to shore to gain some other assistance for these people. And I'm not sure the second why that person was in. But, yeah, that's what they jumped in, and they just didn't come back up.
Yeah.
Wow. So in terms of the actual timing of what you did, now you said it was better when you went in the middle of the night because you don't have interference from other people and resources. And tell us about, is there an opportune time in the sequence of events and when the dog does his or her work and when you use the sonar?
Okay. Typically, you would put the dog out first to actually narrow down your area to see if he can locate anything. One of the misconceptions with a dog is some people think a dog will actually jump off a boat, dive down in the water, and look around. But, in fact, what they're doing is smelling the scent that is actually coming up from the bottom, hitting the surface of the water. And once it hits the surface of the water, that's where the dog is actually catching the scent. And really, at night, it's usually calmer. Like Chuck was saying, there's not a lot of other people, boats, and everything going out there, stirring a lot up. And, you know, the dog doesn't need to see. The dog is totally using his nose. So it's kind of good to put him out there. And when it's calm, quiet, it's actually cooler on the dog. He can work better. And mm-hmm. what we do is when the dog picks up a scent and he will give me his trained indication or his alert, then I will tell somebody that's on the boat that has a GPS, they will mark it for me. And
mm-hmm.
we will mark certain areas. And once we get that area marked, then we go back and it is handed off to Chuck, and then he will know which areas to go out and actually run his sonar in that general area so that he can narrow it down.
Yeah. I think it's amazing for the benefit of the listeners who think that, you know, a search just consists of a bunch of people putting their boots on and heading in the woods, how all of this is coordinated like a ballet. I've seen Monica do a couple of these, and I've seen other people coordinate searches, and there's so much to it. Just like Robin was explaining, the dog does this to this point, then it goes to this point. And I think, you know, the misconception of the public, or they just don't know. If you haven't been on a search, you just don't know how much thinking actually has to go into it.
Right. Can somebody acquaint us with like a brief framework of how you set that up? And then, Chuck, maybe you can go into a little bit about what you actually did in terms of the sonar so that we can get a little acquainted with what you do specifically?
Yeah, we can do that. I mean, one of the things that I am familiar with is that incident command system, which is a move nationally and has been since 2001 when we had the 911 incident to bring agencies, public safety sectors, and government institutions together to be able to manage intelligently incidents. And, you know, you can put definition on incident on that. But there is kind of a format for that. And a lot, when you're dealing with missing people, there's a world of difference between missing on land and missing on the water, and a lot of influencing factors that come to that. So initial response is really critical to be able to gain a hand on incident management itself, and to be able to say, we have the initial SOG SOPs, which determine what we'll do, but it's when those run out of their ability to function and are not producing, we have to look at that and escalate that incident on into the next levels and start doing some incident planning. We do objectives and strategy and tactics, and that determines what happens. Of course, all those are influenced by anything and everything around that. So when we look at water, missing people in the water, it's the time of day that it occurred. Is it a witness, or is it just simply did not return back from a boating trip? What size of area are we working on? There are a number of factors that come in that you have to be able to say, okay, what do we have and what can we work with in what order? And that's where Rob and I had a real good conversation driving over, going down into South Carolina to talk about some things, because people have a little bit misconception on dogs, on sonar, on divers, on what can go on in the water. Mm-hmm. And certainly you'd have to look at when did it occur, how long has it been happening, and where are we in the time frame? Is this the first 24 hours, or is this 48 hours, or is this 72 hours down the road? So that you and what information is known about a last known point, so where we put things in. And in the instance that we were in, there was an area of the lake that was defined, but there was not a close good reference of the last known point. Water is very difficult to put a point on, because there are only references, such as if you're on land, they were near that tree or that bush or that post or whatever. On water,
how do you mark water?
Well, when you're describing to someone, you point with your finger.
Yeah.
And the wider the water is, the broader that point is when you get out there. So you point to a place, and then you drive out, and when it's all said and done, you can be 500 feet or more off, or larger than that if it's a mile wide or so, you can be considerably off. So that's where these dogs come in. And relative to the amount of downtime and when this target underwater starts generating the odors that the dogs pick up, has a bearing on time. So all this has to be taken consideration on: do we put dogs out first and then we run sonar, or do we run sonar waiting for some other effects to happen so the dog can take over?
And, so and it really has depends to be on the situation. Yeah,
you have to understand the situation. In our case, the body had been down long enough that Robin's dog was probably the higher resource to put on the water, and particularly dealing with the time of night that it was. And that's exactly what we did, is we let Robin run out there. Roscoe gave us some points. Robin indicated that we put the GPS positions down and identify that, take that back, and I transferred that to our sonar map and said, okay, here's what the air current's doing, here is what possibly the underwater currents are doing based on any generation of current by the power company. And we say, this is where it's coming to the surface. How far back do we think this could be generating before it actually makes it to the surface? So that's what Roscoe does, is give us these points of where it's surfing, and then we have to look backwards, and that's where the sonar comes in. So it's complex in itself. It's not easy. It's not scientific. It doesn't take rocket scientists to do this, but it just takes the knowledge of people in their expertise areas and working together. So that's what I like about Q. And I think Robin down there, that night we had pretty much to ourselves.
Yes.
We accomplished a lot.
Yeah. Robin, what else do you have to add to that? I know we talked about some other misconceptions with regard to cadaver dogs and scent detection and whatnot. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, what we talked about earlier today?
And like what I was saying, I mean, it is the scent of the body that is decomposing. So, I think a lot of people, they see on TV where they're going and they see a bloodhound tracking somebody, and you go and you get an article and say, here's their scent, go track them. Well, when you're looking for a drowned victim, you don't look, it's not their scent. It is the scent of the body decomposing. So a lot of people have that misconception, thinking you've got to have some kind of article from the people that have drowned for them to pick up that particular scent, where it's not. So, you know, that's one thing is, like I said, you've got to realize the scent. It's all, we all smell alike once we pass away, basically.
Robin?
Uh-huh.
Robin, can you just, and you're hitting on a good point there, which brings out in the resourcing, talk a little bit, if you can, about cadaver dog and tracking dog, trailing dog, and scent dog. Because that's,
okay.
you're absolutely
right.
Correct in there is you've got to bring the right dog in if you're going to be doing that cadaver search. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes,
so
absolutely.
So there's three different categories of dogs, Robin?
Yes. Well, actually, if you want to say there's four, you have tracking where the dog actually puts its nose on the ground and it is tracking a live person. The dog puts its nose to the ground, tracks, never comes up, and it's basically going on the vegetation and all that has actually been pushed down. Then
okay.
you have a trailing dog where it actually trails and picks up the scent that has kind of blown about a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times you see bloodhounds doing that. And again, they're lifeline dogs. Now, they're smelling the person that has maybe Alzheimer's person that's walked away or a child that has walked away or somebody. Then you have an air scent where that dog has actually got its nose up in the air and it is picking up the scent, what's blowing in the wind and up in the air. A cadaver, or what we call now HRD, human remains detection dog, they can do a variety of all of those, from air scent to trailing to tracking, but they're picking up that one target odor of a decomposing body. And
mm-hmm.
so when you've got a drowning, you need a cadaver dog. You don't want to take a lifeline dog out there because the odors are totally different, and if you haven't trained that dog on that scent, then
mm-hmm.
they're not going to locate what you want.
Well, what if you don't know if they're living or they passed, what, you know, in terms of the scent, what dog would you bring?
You mean, well, on the water, you know you're going to need a cadaver dog.
Okay.
Because they're down in the water, they've drowned.
Mm-hmm.
When you're out on the land, depending on how long they've been gone, you know, their medical condition, if it is something and they haven't been missing that long, and you will go from the point last seen, say from the house, then you will take what we call a lifeline dog and start with the lifeline, and they will track them or trail them as to where they've walked away.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody has been missing for weeks, years, months, whatever, then you bring in your HRD cadaver dog because, you know, at that point you are looking for the remains.
Right.
But initially if it's, you know, within like the first day or so and there would be no reason to think that they have passed away, you would bring in a lifeline dog.
Mm-hmm. Now, does somebody that does this kind of work that you do, do you typically have at least access to all of those different types
Absolutely.
Of dogs in terms
yes.
of ownership?
On our team, Cumberland Canine Search and Recovery, we actually have five HRD dogs or cadaver dogs, and we do have one lifeline bloodhound. So depending on the circumstances, whatever we get called out, we will decide which dog. Now, initially when Roscoe was trained, he was actually cross-trained, and he was initially trained lifeline and also cadaver, but pretty much towards the end of it, I strictly just worked him on water because we live around land between the lakes, Kentucky and Barkley Lakes, and that's where most of our calls were coming was from drownings. You can cross-train a dog to do both. Right now, the dog I have just certified and trained, I pretty much have stayed with one discipline, which is the HRD. But we do have access on our team to both type dogs.
Wow. Now, it's true that someone can be missing for a number of years and they can still pick up the scent, is what you were telling me about the Indian burial grounds that he picked up?
Absolutely, yes. They have got it documented in studies. That a dog can go back hundreds of years. And for instance, Roscoe, we were doing a search up on the other side of Kansas City, Missouri, looking for a missing person. He had been gone for like 7 years. And the area I was searching, my dog gave me an indication of he was picking up something, but really wasn't quite sure. It wasn't his hard trained alert. We marked the general area. We brought in another dog. That dog started doing the same thing. Eventually, we brought in 14 dogs. All of these dogs were giving us indication there's something here. Some of the dogs were actually going up to the trees and trying to smell up in the trees. They did bring in some heavy equipment, started digging, and it was actually an Indian burial ground that they had located. So
Yay.
It was hundreds of years old, but they were still picking up enough of that scent.
Wow, that is so cool. I just can't imagine that. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Wow.
Robin brings up a good point, you know, that people think that the scent does go away, and, you know, she certainly has got, several finds in areas out there that she's worked in with that, and I have to echo that in one of our searches up in Virginia was probably about somewhere I believe was around maybe a 15-year-old possible homicide case, and
yeah.
some information came to light that this person or object of interest may have been in this body of water. Dogs were initially brought in, the cadaver dogs were initially brought in, and yes, did indicate some interest in detecting the remains scent.
Mm-hmm.
We came in at that particular time, we put divers in the water and did some areas. It was not very deep and it was not very large. And we used some metal detecting, thinking that, you know, we could pick up belt buckles or zippers or some piece of clothing that they may have had that still have had metal on that.
Mm-hmm.
And searched for probably the better part of a day, and did not turn anything that shed any light on what we were looking for, any objects of interest at all. Yet the dog remained steadfast in saying, I'm smelling what I'm supposed to be smelling. You know, you guys are not finding it out there. What it came out is someone just stumbled across, well, what if this person, as in with the burial grounds, as Robin just indicated, what if this person had been buried? And, of course, there was a hillside leading down into this pond drainage area. Did some digging around using the dog with digging and were able to track back up, and what they were looking for had been buried back up on the hillside, and this was just over the years, it was just leaching down into the lake or into
mm-hmm.
that pond thing. So yeah, that scent is out there for
yep.
considerable time. That's with the Q Center, that's their importance there is a lot of times Q is not the primary initial response in, and they come in after local resources have been exhausted, and maybe even years later as new information is discovered or given to a detective, because the case is not a closed, you know, it's just an inactive, but they get new things. That's where people like Robin and Monica come in. And
right.
Yes, there's things to do and things can be done.
Yeah, well, Robin, as the state outreach coordinator, can you explain to us a little bit regarding what Chuck alluded to, saying that after the local resources are exhausted, then Q picks up? I mean, what would be the difference in terms of what the state would typically do and then when Q comes in?
Well, I think initially when there is a missing person filed, you know, and if it gets a lot of publicity, some do, some don't. The police will initially go out. They will try to track down leads, try to find it. But, you know, their resources are limited, you know, and they've got so many other cases and other things to do. So they pretty much put it on the back burner.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Q Center will get a call. For instance, as a state outreach coordinator, I got contacted by a person that had been referred to me about a missing nephew and was wanting help. What I will do is I direct them to the Q Center. They will go in, register this missing person. Q Center gets all the necessary information they need. They get the family to sign release forms and all, which will enable them to be able to go to local law enforcement, get the records, look and see what they've done, the circumstances, and the knowledge that Monica has and a lot of her team. They will start compiling information, and if they come up with anything credible, then she will put it out there, hey, we're going to have a search. I need dogs. I need ATVs, horses, sonar, whatever. She pulls in the resources, and we will go out and actually start doing searches and trying to locate these missing persons.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all 100% volunteer. None of us get paid for our services. The family is not charged one dime.
Wow. That's the incredible part. How long is there a typical time frame in terms of how long this is all pulled together? Is there ever the scenario where I just can't find the help I need in this area?
And we see that. I know at the conference, and I'm not. You may have met this one lady, but she was desperate. She had done everything she could to try to locate her daughter that went missing in another state. She had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, had lost her home trying to do everything, and, I mean, it just fizzled. She couldn't get any help anymore, and somehow she found out about the Q Center and came from our conference, and now the Q Center has taken over her case.
Uh-huh.
And is putting out there, and everything is being pulled together, and if we end up getting enough information that it's, we think it's possible to have a search in an area, then one will be called, and we will go out there and try to look for her daughter.
That's tremendous.
You know, it could be anywhere from somebody just went missing, you know, a week, 2 weeks, or even that day versus years later. So, you know, there's never any time frame as far as, it's been too many years, we're not going to take your case.
Right.
See, Monica's credibility comes in. When she initially started, it was a very steep, long, uphill climb to get in to be able to do things she wants to do. Because when you're dealing with a lot of this, you're dealing with a jurisdictional area. It's a law enforcement concern. It's a missing person.
Right.
And that has legal aspects to it. The authority to do things are be in places. Sometimes search warrants have to be obtained. The object of search could be in one jurisdictional area, but the missing person report is in another jurisdiction, and you have to get those people to work together. So, you know, it's a battle sometimes to be able to pull off and get some of these searches coordinated that Monica does. But thank goodness
she's
been doing
it long
enough.
Right, because you have to know all the resources.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, and you've got to know the processes. You've got to be able to go to law enforcement and say, we've got information and we've got these people lined up to help. Is that okay with you guys? Because, you know, you first of all, you have to have permission to go on. If it's private property, you've got to have permission to go on that. And, you know, those are warrants drawn from a local magistrate, and that's where the local law enforcement comes in to help with getting that process done. Otherwise, you're trespassing if you just go out on someone else's property.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a lot of legal side of this.
Sure. Delilah, in working with other missing persons organizations that you have over the years, and there's many of them, there's the one in Michigan, there's others that we know of, do they also work in the same format procedurally, or do they have to also build rapport with law enforcement in order to get the things done they need to, or does it just depend upon their focus?
Now, I would assume that each of them would have to follow the same protocols. Now, you know, talking about different missing persons organizations, now there's other organizations available out there that don't do the same things. You know, someone may have an organization that's more of a support and awareness. You know, there are different organizations that play different roles, and each and every one of them is important. Q Center happens, in my opinion, to kind of have the whole enchilada going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a Q Center type agency, say, in all four corners of the U.S., or, you know, if I lived in San Diego, and I know that they have clients all over the country, but is there such an organization that pulls all the resources together like Q in all the major, corners of the U.S.?
I would have to defer that probably off to Robin
I'm not sure. I just know what the Q, I mean, she will take them all over the United States.
Yeah.
And eventually we just started the state outreach coordinator. It just came about the first of this year. Eventually, she wants to have a minimum of one in every state, and even, you know, 3 to 4 if she can even get more. Right now, we do not have them in every state. So, but that is her future, to have that.
How is she doing with that goal, by the way, since March or whatnot? Do you know?
Honestly, I'm not sure. We have got quite a few. I think we probably have maybe 15 to 20, although we've got 2 to 3 in some states. Tennessee, I'm the only one at this point. Hopefully we will get a couple more. But, you know, it's just she's trying to build it up, and it's, you know, something that it will turn out to be great, because that we're getting more and more cases every day, and as people find out about the Q Center, and it will allow us to be able to help more people. So that, you know, a dream of Monica's, and she's done an outstanding job, and she's like our mentor, and eventually she will keep building us to the point where we can take some of this off of her and be able to actually handle cases without her having to come in and do everything.
Right. Well, I've got to say real quickly that this has been, I think, just a fantastic way to coordinate this. And I've seen some of the things that you've all pulled together already in just this short a period of time, and it's amazing to me. And, you know, I know that this is going to be the solution to a lot of the things that Monica is up against. You know, one person just can't do it all. And I know, you know, she must appreciate you all so deeply.
Yeah, I think that's for sure. Maybe this, Robin, maybe this is a prime opportunity to talk about the fundraiser coming up while we're talking about that.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, as a state outreach coordinator for Tennessee, I would like to invite everybody out. It's called Nashville Cares About the Missing and Exploited. And it is going to be, if you want to call it a concert or performances by some up-and-coming country music performers. It's going to be July the 13th at the Hard Rock Cafe, which is in downtown Nashville. The doors are going to open at 7, and it's only a minimum of a $5 donation, which we hope we will get more people will want to pay more, but minimum is $5, and all proceeds, everything will be donated to the Q Center. That will help to be able to get these searches out there to help people. Like I said, there's no charges for our services, but when you try to pull in together 100-plus people and try to find lodging, food, and all of that, you know, we work off a donation. So this is going to be a great, great thing. I think everybody will enjoy it. Some wonderful talent's going to be there. So anybody that's able to come, if not, and you just want to make a donation, you can go to the Q Center's website, and there's a link there where you can actually make a donation. But it's Nashville Cares About the Missing and Exploited at the Hard Rock Cafe, July the 13th at 7 o'clock.
That's wonderful. It looks like there's about 9 or 10 performers that are going to be performing, and it's a really cool event, and I'm sure it would appeal to a lot of people. So that's great. Hey Chuck, I was wondering, would you mind talking about training for your specialty, and if anyone is under the illusion that they can just kind of go out and buy a little bit of equipment and do this, you know, on Saturdays for fun? It's not the case, right?
Well, that's really not the case. When you talk sonar, you're talking a number of different manufacturers' products, and you talk everything from the not so expensive to some highly expensive and sophisticated equipment. You know, obviously, if you invest $100,000 in your equipment, it's probably going to function at a different level than if, say, your product maybe is only a $2,000 piece of equipment.
Right.
So not all sonar provides the display in the identical way. I mean, sonar is sonar, but how you get it on the screen and how the sonar returns or interpreted and displays, you know, is the product itself. All of these things work out of the box. For the most part, you know, there's quality control in manufacturing, and they're tested before they ship out, and these things will turn on, and some lights will come on, and some things will happen. It is the operator's responsibility to be able to say, this is what I'm seeing on the screen. And a lot of times, what we're looking for is not going to be the object that, if you were looking at it with your eyes, it's an electronic representation. And that's also influenced by anything else that's around this object that is also pinging back the signals. So while, yes, it does work out of the box, it takes a tremendous amount of running the unit to determine its capabilities, to become familiar with what is normal bottom return for the area, and then when you're putting it into an application, is to say, I see something that does not appear to be normal type return for this area. Mm-hmm. And
Chuck,
then,
can you give us just a sonar 101? What is the definition of what does sonar do? If there are people listening and they're thinking, I think I know, but I'm not quite sure. Can you just tell us what is the purpose of sonar? What does it do for us?
Sonar, sound and navigation recording, is what it is comes up to, and what it is, it's a sound frequency that is generated by a transducer in the water as a transmission medium. It'll send out a power level of a signal referred to as most commonly as a ping. Okay, and listening at different sonars, if you watch some of the old movies, you hear these ping-ding, all right, mm-hmm. as to whether it's a pinging noise or it's a tick-tick-tick type noise. This is the transducer sending it out. Well, it sends this out. The way that this worked is as when that signal, and it's just a short duration in burst, when that little piece of signal is sent out, if it hits another object, then that object, depending on its softness or hardness, either absorbs some of the signal and returns some of the signal. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's hard and soft or difference on that, and you have to look at that coming back. So that signal then comes back to the unit, and it interprets the level of that signal coming back and says, okay, this is going to be a high-intensity return, being I'm looking at a hard object, or it's a low-intensity return, being a soft object, and put this up on the screen. Now, this happens many, 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 many times over, you know, over a second, so that the displays are built out. Now, as you're doing this, realizing everything that's out there is returning or absorbing back, so that's where you get your picture built on the bottom of a soft return. If you've got a hard return around it, that all those hard returns end up building a shape as mm-hmm. as you move those pings down through time. And that's really how sonar operates itself. It works in water. It does not work in air. And that's some of the other operational characteristics you have to understand.
Is there a graphic picture on the screen that you get?
It's a pattern, a graphic,
or configuration?
It's a pattern, and it's based on the algorithms that the sonar manufacturer uses to display the strength or it's displaying the strength of the return. And mm-hmm. and again, you know, whether it's a lot of signal coming back and it bounced off a hard object, if it's not much of that power, it knows how much power it sent out on that signal, and it mm-hmm. looks for something coming back and determines that level back. So a hard object reflects a lot of signal back. A soft object absorbs it, so the signal level coming back is low. And then the program, that graphic program on that screen then builds those representations. And it can build 3D pictures under there. And look at it as if you were looking for a boat, you can possibly see an outline of a boat underwater, you know, laying on the bottom. One of the misconceptions on the cadaver search or the body search that we do out there is that return, based on what the bottom consistency is, doesn't always look like arms and legs hanging out there. So a lot of times you've got to go in and interpret again that return that does not appear to be part of the bottom, normal bottom returns, and say that little orange dot that I'm looking at here doesn't appear to coincide with all the other color dots that I'm seeing down here. And it may not be a shape of a human body. Mm-hmm. And that just takes time.
Yeah. Is it a long, comparatively speaking, like Robin, with the amount of time that you put in with your dog to the use of sonar and locating something, is the use of the dog more efficient than the amount of time it takes to do the sonar technique? I'm just wondering.
Was that a question to Robin?
Well, either one of you, but I'm just wondering, Robin, I mean, in your experience, is it, you know, yours is kind of more quickly done versus what they do with the sonar?
Well, I will say we work hand in hand, and since sonar has come about, and if you get the people like Chuck that are knowledgeable and know what they're doing with sonar, I
yeah.
love working with those type people because it makes the recovery of the body so much easier and quicker. You know, so, I mean, for years, we didn't have anybody that could do sonar, or nobody even really knew about it around here. And just in the last couple of years have I really started working with people with sonar and working with knowledgeable people. And I will say Chuck is probably the best sonar person I have ever worked with.
Oh,
and, yes, he is. I mean, and we had a fascinating talk. Like I said, the three-hour trip down that we took early that morning through a storm and all. But, you know,
yeah.
it just adds the value. It's just another piece of it. If you've got it, it makes it so much better. You can recover the body quicker. It also, when you're sending a diver down, like he said,
yep.
the dogs are going to put you in the general area, but I cannot point down and say it's right here because we've got current. We've got wind, you know, so you've got a general area that you can give them, but you cannot pinpoint that body. Well, if you're putting a diver down there, it could be dangerous. So if you've got sonar that can come in and actually zero in on it,
right.
it makes it a whole lot, it's a lot safer, and the recovery's a lot quicker. So they go hand in hand. If you can get them together, they're wonderful to work together.
That's great.
They do, and looking at the sonar is – The value of the sonar is to the operator that says we see on the display a target signature that indicates this is what we are looking for. The
mm-hmm.
other piece of that is when you're searching is to be able to come back and to say 99.9% the target of interest is not seen within the search area. Now, that's where you've got to have a good sonar operator, because the last thing you want to say is we didn't
yep. –
you don't want to come out and say we didn't find anything.
Yep.
And you don't want to say we didn't see any targets there and then have that target float, you know, 2, 3, 4 days later.
Mm-hmm.
So
then do you just move to another quadrant of your search area?
That's what you do. Then you kind of regroup and say we feel that we have covered this area sufficiently that what you seek is not in there. What do we know that would tell us now where do we want to set the next grid up? And see, that could be over a period of time where Robin ran at midnight. And Robin, you ran till what, about 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that?
Yeah, I think, well, actually I got out, what, about 1:30, and I ran maybe an hour. Then remember we came in gave you, and you actually kind of went out and did a little bit, and then we looked at it, but... Something else, like he was saying, at the point I go out, depending on how long that body's been underwater, the temperature of it and all, the body will eventually begin to start floating on you.
Uh-huh.
So if you don't, you know, there could be a time, yeah, I'm picking up something here, but now all of a sudden the body's hit, it's in current, and it's beginning to move on them. So
that makes it a lot more difficult, obviously,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, and like Chuck said, there's a lot of things you have to take into consideration. You just can't run out, well, the dog is alerting here, it's right here, he goes out. You know, you've got to put a lot of things into it and figure out depth, current, you know, how long has the body been down there, what's the temperature, that type thing.
Wow.
The piece that we went on, and I'm sorry, go ahead, Robin, you weren't finished.
I was just thinking of a related question. When a lot of people think about the dogs and the scent, do they, when they lose a scent, what happens behaviorally with the dog, and what is the reason for losing the scent?
Well, when you take them out of the target area, when I put him on the water, I start, and depending on the wind, the direction of the wind, how I want to move him, and I kind of do like a grid search, when he starts coming into odor, I can tell by his body language, he's fixing to come into odor, he will give me his alert, I will
mm-hmm.
tell him to mark it. As we move out of that odor, the dog will calm back down, and he will relax, whatever, won't do much. We'll take him completely out of that area, I can bring him back in. As we're coming back in, he'll pick that scent back up. When it gets to the strongest part of it, he'll do his alert. We take him out. I can do that with him like 3 times, but once I've taken him in that area, that target area, about 3 times, After that, he's finished. I'll have to pull him off the water, keep him off probably 30, 45 minutes to an hour. I can put him back at that point, and then he'll work again.
So that but after a while, he's too tired.
After a while, it's like, Mom, what else do you want me to do? I told you it's here, and I told you, you know. So
say he alerts, is there a particular, like, a body posturing of the dog?
Yes,
do you,
Robin.
Do they get
you...
very stiff or their nose is up in the air? What does that mean?
I'm pulling Robin's chain right now because it's good that she has to answer this question that you asked, Donna.
Okay.
Go ahead, Robin.
I can just tell by his body language that my dog is in odor and that he is giving me his final indication. I will leave it at that. I can read my dog. Every handler needs to know how to read their dog. With my dog, though, anybody that's on the boat or can see, they will know by the way my dog acts, my dog is in odor.
Maybe we're
talking about a little gross territory or something. I don't know.
He is a male dog, and I will leave it at that.
Okay, that's fine. Delilah, why don't you come in with a couple questions here?
Well, I think should you again for the benefit of our listeners. What if someone had the passion and the heart to become trained to be a searcher?
Right.
What kind of process would they have to go through?
From the Robin standpoint, she has agencies, recognized agencies that provide certification.
Absolutely.
And have standards that are out there to meet to be able to provide these services. On our sonar, there aren't standards out here to do that on the sonar piece, so the only thing we can say is you've got to know your equipment, all right? And as far as training, there's not any really great training-type programs. That's why the Q updates that we do sometimes can be beneficial. No training out there on the sonar, and all we can do is tell people, run it, run it, run it, run it till you sleep with it. So that's on the sonar side. Robin, if you want to go and get into NASAR and these things, go ahead.
Right, and with a dog in my case, my dogs, we train, and typically it takes to train and have an operational working search dog, in my case an HRD dog, it's anywhere from 18 months to 2 years. And, I mean, it is a lot of work. It's a lot of time. I go to seminars. I work with a master trainer out of Illinois. I get them to the point, and, like, I just certified my dog, my latest dog that I'm going to start working. She is a 2-year-old Labradoodle. And in March, she just got certified through the North American Work Dog Association, which is a police organization.
Mm-hmm.
I am sponsored by the Henry County Sheriff's Department. And a master trainer comes down, and they will set up problems that have cadaver, anywhere from water to buried so deep to in cars. I mean, it's 12 problems, and you have to find successfully 11 of 12 to pass. It's a very stringent, but at least, I mean, it's, you know, anybody can go out there and say, well, I've got a search dog. Well, to get them to the level and what you really need and get them, you need to have them certified. And, and that certification lasts a year, and it's handler and dog. And so we're deployable, and like I say, I am sponsored through the Sheriff's Department.
And is that typical, or do they people, if they have the funds, and I don't know how much it costs to do that, can you say, is it a few $100s, or?
You mean to train a cadaver dog?
Or to get the certification?
The certification, the only thing, only charge it is a $45 membership that you have to pay, but you have to be sponsored by a canine handler within a sheriff's department or some kind of police department.
Uh-huh.
But all they charge is $45. Then they have seminars, and they come down, and they will send master trainers down to actually test you. But, no, they don't. But to get to that point that you're ready to test,
mm-hmm.
You can spend hundreds into thousands of dollars if you want to do it right, to go to the seminars you need to go to different places, the time. I mean, you can't just train at home all the time. You've got to go out, expose your dog to all kinds of environments and different situations.
Wow.
So,
yes, it's
Yeah, it's not cheap, and you can use any kind of dog. It's not necessarily, I work labs and labradoodles, but
right.
You could get one out of pound, but that does not mean every dog will do this. Not every dog will take to the scent.
Right. I was thinking there must be particular breeds like Labradors, I don't know, German Shepherds, I don't know
no.
what they are because I'm not really versed in it. Are there particular breeds that would definitely not be a search and rescue dog, or can you train most breeds?
You can train probably any breed. Generally, you see the bigger dogs, the ones that have a more of a stamina, German Shepherds, Labradors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. Those are probably the two. I now also have a Labradoodle that I've started working. So, you know, you can work anything. I have a friend, she actually has an Airedale that she's working.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, there's
wow.
mixed breeds. It's
mm-hmm.
There is no set standard. It's kind of what your preference is. But again, not every Labrador will do it, not every German Shepherd, not every Malinois. But you could just go get one, you know, maybe you found it and it's a rescue dog. A lot of those will turn out to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, it is not breed specific. Generally, though, you've got a bigger, you don't have, like, smaller chihuahuas, that type thing. Because of the area, when we do land searches, I mean, you've got a lot of area. That dog has got to have the stamina to last.
Right, and be strong. And
yeah.
Chuck, since you, since there's not the certification behind it or as many people, are you someone that's very much in demand throughout the nation? Do you go and do a lot of training for other people if this is a relatively new developing resource? You said it by a couple of years.
Well, I think it's a new developing resource in terms of affordability. Back, if you get some of your high-end dollars out there where you're spending a bunch of $1,000 for units, so these manufacturers do have a one-day or maybe a two-day type training class. Again, that is with any type training, it's basic training, so it's going to that lets you learn how to kind of operate and interpret. You've still got to go out and get your experience on that. With
mm-hmm.
the newer more affordable, low-costing units out here in these $2,000 to $3,000 range, no, there's no training that comes with that. And do we do that? Not really. And I guess I won't get too much into that other than to say that people
yeah,
buy these things.
Yeah, we've got about 2.5 minutes.
Okay, they expect these things to perform magic when they come out of the box, and the manufacturer just says, yes, it will turn on, but it's on the operator to learn how to use it and make it effective and to know when the limits of that unit has been reached and to call for another resource. So egos do play into this a little bit, too.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, in the parting time that we have here, if there's a particular message that each of you would like to get out with regard to search and rescue overall, if there's another misconception or something that the public should know, can you each make a brief comment for me?
Sure. I'll start on that and just simply say that when you're dealing with a missing person, that's a loved one from some family. And you can close cases out for lack of information, but to the family until you can return that missing object, the healing of the heart will never happen. So that's what we really
that's
strive
true.
To do out here, is get
wow.
that heart healed by closing it to the family in their heart.
That's true. What do you have to say, Robin?
And I will agree exactly what he said, you know. I mean, I do it for the love of the dog, and I'm fascinated by how the dog works and everything. But, you know, bottom line, when it comes, if you can bring closure to that family and just see the gratitude they will give back to you, it is so worth it. It is just unbelievable, you know, that and what it will do. And I can say I have met some absolutely wonderful people by going
mm-hmm.
in and doing this, some of my dear close friends now, by getting in and doing this because – these are people that have a true heart, and they
that's
care about
wonderful.
People.
Yeah, well, that's great, and I thank you both so much for being our guests tonight. I hope you'll keep in touch with me. I've made a couple of new friends now.
Absolutely.
Let's please do that. Maybe we can utilize you again, I'm sure, because we work with the missing all the time, right, Delilah? And I just like to say next week we have coming up a good show, a great show with Kim Anklin and her sister Kristen. I believe they're talking about sexual harassment issues and civil suits. And Kim's sister Kristen, I believe, is an ex-law enforcement officer that has dealt with many issues. So it's going to be fascinating. Thank you so much, everyone. Go to www.donnagore.com and imaginepublicity.com. Thank you, Robin. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Delilah. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chuck.
Okay.